This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Academic Life. This is the podcast for your academic journey and beyond. I'm the podcast creator and the show host, Dr. Christina Gessler, and today we're pleased to be joined by Dr. Nisandra Nkwala, who's going to share with us about 100 years of radio in Africa. Welcome to the show, Professor.
Thank you so much, Christina. It's really a privilege to be here.
I am so glad you're here and that we're going to learn from your expertise about the 100-year anniversary of radio in Africa and specifically your area of expertise, which is its role in South Africa. Before we dive into all of that, will you please tell us about yourself?
Yes. So I am a South African media academic. I started off as a practicing journalist, worked for 10 years as a radio journalist, and then transitioned into academia, where my focus has been on studying media ecologies and rhetoric in media ecologies in South Africa, with an interest in traditional media, in particular radio and print. And in 2023, it was the 100th year anniversary of the first official broadcast of radio in South Africa. So we've been celebrating that 100 year mark and probably will continue celebrating it until December this year, 2024. One of the ways that we marked the occasion was with the publication of two volumes called 100 Years of Radio, where I was co-editor. And in the two volumes, we essentially traced the history of radio. And yeah, so it's been exciting this year that in the World Radio Day celebrations for 2024, UNESCO also had a similar theme celebrating a centenary of radio broadcasting globally. And some colleagues and I got together to talk about radio in Africa more broadly. And yes, so that got written up as an article in The Conversation. And it's been really great to see how that has grown legs and sparked an interest in radio and its place in African society and communities.
There's so much I want to unpack about that. Can we start with what the term media ecologies means?
So it's essentially the ecosystems in which media operate. So from the media platforms to the audiences, to all the spaces where they have an impact in Africa. Those could include classrooms where radio is used to teach. So all of the spaces that feed into media and that media feed into and that shape each other, essentially.
You said you have a background in journalism. What made you want to make the leap into being a professor?
To be honest, I worked for 10 years and I just wanted to slow down the pace a bit. At the time when I was really working at transitioning from media into academia, we had a series of university protests in South Africa where students were calling for free education and a decolonized approach to higher education, which was 2016, 2015, 2017. And that really took its toll on me because we were out in the field daily and it just felt like a lot. So I thought I don't want to leave thinking about media, creating media completely. I'm not keen to do something independently. So academia seemed very attractive to me. Also, just watching what was happening in that space and the potential of the classroom to impact the newsroom really started to like eat away, not eat away, but really mulled around in my mind. So I transitioned, and it allows me the best of both worlds. So I still play around a little bit with creation of media content, but now I get to train students on how to do radio, television, and I get to research it. So I'm getting a lot just, in academia.
In Western cultures, streaming and podcasting has really taken over as the medium where people get information, but that is not so throughout the entire continent of Africa. Radio still is incredibly important. As you celebrate this 100-year anniversary, what about that would you like to highlight for us?
So there are a few things, and the first is the fact that people are asking, even in different African countries, does radio still have a place? And the people who are asking are the people who are on social media. The advent of platforms like Spaces and some of the podcasting platforms have made people question whether the way that we've grown up listening to radio is still going to exist. So we were interested in that. And in South Africa in 2022, we had a census results coming out, and it actually saw that the number of people who own radio sets has decreased, the physical radio sets, but people are listening still to traditional radio in other ways. So the issue of what does this digital age mean for this medium that on the continent has been more than just information. It's really a platform to mobilize. It's a platform for people to express solidarity, to engage, to have a voice, to teach. And it's the changes, which some might view as a demise, do sometimes feel like they could be a threat. So that, I think, is the one aspect. The other aspect is the platforms that digital technologies present do also have an added benefit that radio doesn't in the African context. So in the history of radio, the trend has been for states to really co-opt the medium for their own ends. And platforms like podcasts present an opportunity really for people to create their own content and disseminate it to reach audiences that would have been gate-kept through traditional radio. So that is another that's another interesting aspect. And then lastly, the place of indigenous African languages in online spaces. So when I'm not researching radio, one of the other things I'm interested in is indigenous or multilingual education and multilingual media. And one of the things that we've seen with the scholarship is the risk of indigenous languages dying out in online platforms as languages like English and Western languages become the languages we use in these spaces. So digital media, audio particularly, presents a challenge to this, and it could be an opportunity to have indigenous languages present in online spaces. So all of those dynamics make it something that we are thinking about as scholars of traditional radio in the African context, both these opportunities, but also the challenges that the digital media presents.
In the 100-year history and going back to where it started, it was actually used by the colonial powers, brought in by them, and most of the broadcasts that were available were in languages like English and French. Can you take us back to where its roots were and what the colonial powers were intending radio to do throughout the continent?
Radio in the African context started in the early 1920s with amateur broadcasters just playing around with the medium. The very first official broadcast is said to have happened on the 18th of December in Johannesburg, South Africa in 1923. marking really the beginning of the use of the medium in this context. But the predominant languages that it was brought, used in were colonial languages, because the primary audiences were people stationed in African countries from the colonies, so from Britain and France. And there were different approaches, with the view being to give these people stationed in the colonies a sense of home through the music, through the conversations they would have been used to, and information as to what was going on in their countries. So African audiences and African languages were really completely sidelined until the 1940s, early 1940s, with the outbreak of the Second World War. And then there was a realization that radio could play a role in shaping the hearts and minds of the indigenous people, the Africans on the continent. One historian says it happened when there was a rumor during the rounds that Hitler had promised to give, I think, 2 pence or some like minuscule amount of money to people who supported Germany in the war. So they recognized the power of using the medium of radio and using it in African languages to try and speak to the hearts and minds of the indigenous language speakers. And in the South African context, it was in 1941, the very first broadcast in isiZulu took place. And really, the difference was seen. Even though the broadcasts were heavily censored, the content that the broadcasters shared was monitored and really vetted, they did find ways through the use of language to assert what minimal agency they could. And so I think the story of how radio developed is quite interesting. So it started on the ground with amateurs co-opted by the state to exclude, and then realizing that you could actually use the medium to shape opinions, bringing in the languages of the majority, and then the majority using their agency to assert their voices. So that is essentially how the introduction of radio happened in this context.
So it's been used as a tool for propaganda, for information, for dispelling disinformation, but it's also been used for resistance. You talk about resistance radio and the importance of bringing silenced voices into expression through radio and now through podcasts.
Yes. And one example that we have in the South African context is the introduction or the use of a radio station called Radio Freedom. It was a station that did not necessarily broadcast from South Africa, but it was the station of the African National Congress, which was really one of the liberation parties in our context. And it came at a time when the African National Congress and a lot of the leaders were banned from speaking and being out in public by the apartheid regime. But Radio Freedom became the platform that they could use to speak to the ANC supporters and other South Africans who wanted to keep the momentum of the fight against apartheid going. So you see, because it is a medium through AM and through FM and basically the airwaves being able to penetrate through whatever blockades the state would have put in place, it is able to be used by people to resist. And it's not only in the South African context. My colleagues who were part of the article, we have a colleague who wrote about Tanzania, one who wrote about Zimbabwe, Mauritius, and Ghana and Kenya. really highlighting how in their context, in different ways. So in Zimbabwe, for example, one of the challenges is the fact that people who are not on the state side do not get licenses. And so it's difficult to actually get permission to broadcast, but people find clandestine ways to get their message across through the airwaves. So it is made possible because of the technology itself and different to platforms like television, where the technology just presents a barrier because of how expensive it is.
In the article, and I'm presuming also in the book, you talk about how prevalent radio is and why. There's a technology divide still. TVs are expensive. Radio is a more affordable device to use to get information. And having that audio information freely available is still culturally the go-to, where people are going to get their news, where they're going to get their information. Can you talk about radio in context, please?
Okay. There's the physical technology that we speak about, and just the access to a radio set being manifold times cheaper than accessing television, and still manifold times cheaper than accessing a device like a smartphone. And so in just the physical costs, that's the one aspect. But there's also the ability for audiences to shape content. And in the African context, television is still very much gate-kept. So you need to be invited to a program to appear on television. Even in online spaces, your voice doesn't matter unless you are really an influencer. But on radio, you can call in and be part of a discussion and the kinds of conversations that happen. On the one hand, you could have someone calling in high up in government to give their view, and the next speaker is an ordinary person, an ordinary community member. So the kind of public sphere that we see that radio presents in the African context really is, in my view, and in the view of some of the contributors in the book, the most democratic public sphere, where different voices can come in and the barriers of entry are much lower than other mediums. The other point is just the disparities in access across things like gender, where women in online spaces, they may own a phone that could access radio, but things like access to data mean that their participation is a lot lower than men. And we see that in one of the Afrobarometer surveys that we talk about in the article, although we don't go into detail. So that disparity in access and the issue of languages as well. The online spaces, although people are claiming them with indigenous languages, are still very English focused in the South African context, whereas you've got radio stations here in every single of the 12 official languages. So both in terms of the technology, the access, and the kind of participation that can happen on radio, it really is a medium that gives people an opportunity to have a voice and participate meaningfully compared to others.
I'm curious about the people who call in to participate. For positionality of where I am in the US, if you call a radio station, if they invite people to call in, it is very rare for you to be chosen to be one of the people who speaks on air. Most people who have tried calling end up being on hold for a long period of time and never being chosen. Is there an expectation for these programs that if you call in, you have a high likelihood of being part of the on-air speaking community?
That's a very interesting question, Christina. I'm not sure. I don't know if there've been studies on audience participation that have been done that can definitively say that. But anecdotally, I can speak anecdotally from listening in, the variety of people that you hear, and having worked behind the scenes, the variety of people and voices that you hear, and the length of time that certain programs devote to the voices of different people would incline me to say that there is a very high chance that if you are calling in, you would participate, you would be able to participate. Nowadays, we also have WhatsApp, where people send in voice notes. So even if you're not calling directly, you share your view and then you send it through the WhatsApp voice note, which has presented a new avenue. But I know, you know, as someone who had worked behind radio, that unless, and sometimes you get listeners who are like regular callers and who tend to want to dominate conversations, and we come to know them as producers. So unless you may be one of those, if you are calling in and you genuinely want to express an opinion, you do have a platform. And the other thing that tends to also characterize programming, particularly on talk radio, is that the conversations, especially on issues of national importance, happen throughout the day. So if there's an issue maybe about electricity, it's going to keep coming up in different programs. So if time perhaps ran out in one program, there's in the breakfast program, there's an opportunity maybe at lunchtime or in the evening programs, because those conversations are ongoing. So I think, yeah, what you're pointing out is would be an interesting thing to research. But speaking anecdotally, I can say that the voices that we hear are definitely diverse enough to assume that people who are calling in are given the opportunity.
And it seems then that listeners would have this sense that the programs that they're listening to throughout the day really are in touch with the community, with their voices, with their issues and concerns, as opposed to podcasts that are listened to that are created outside community and even outside the continent.
Yes, I think that is one of the challenges of podcasting in our context. Because radio is structured around people's days, I'm not sure in the States, but in the morning you would have the general current affairs conversations. In the mid-morning, it's for people who are assumed to be at home, and then lunch proceeds, you know, for people who are at work and maybe taking a lunch break, and then you've got a drive time show. There's a great variety from radio dramas. We even have some stations where there are prayer services, just different things happening, where on a podcast you are going in with a specific interest. And I think with the listening patterns of the majority of South Africans, that diversity is something people still enjoy. I was asked in an interview I did, I think last year, on whether the podcasts don't present a better space for people who are just interested in a topic to gather and have that conversation. And my view was the ability to dip in and out as well of conversations that radio presents is something that is interesting and that keeps audiences engaged, as opposed to a podcast where you know it's just this one topic. So yes, I think because of the fact that our lives really revolve around the programming has been set up in such a way that it revolves around our lives, it is a place where we gather with our ears to dip in and dip out, speak to what is relevant, and listen to new things that we may not be aware of.
I'm wondering if it's then generative for face-to-face conversations, that the community that they've been listening to on the radio then becomes the community of conversations you have with the people you're actually sitting down to have lunch with, or the people that you actually work in an office with.
Nowadays, I think it's both. I mean, there was certainly a time where radio set the agenda of what we would talk about, where we could say, did you hear on the radio, this happened this morning, and it would be something we are all engaged in off air, if I can call it that. But now we definitely see conversations happening maybe on public transport, where a radio host, because for us as well, what is interesting is although radio practitioners and journalists are somewhat in the elite group in terms of maybe education and their positioning socially, they are also very much in communities. So people are using public transport and listening to the conversations that are happening there, and then saying, today in the taxi, this is what, and our taxis are like 16-seater minibuses. So I'm using it in that sense, not an American cab. So did you hear today in the taxi, this, or today as I was driving in the, as I was riding in the taxi, this was the conversation, what do you think? And then, you know, people call in and give their opinions. So I think it's both ways. And social media also does feed into radio programming. A study that we did on young people in the Western Cape, for example, looked at how, as much as they may not call into radio stations as much as older people, they are contributing to content through social media by posting topics for radio stations to discuss about what is going on in their context. So it's no longer one directional where radio shapes the agenda. It's both directions. Radio is shaping the conversations we have, and the conversations that we have are shaping the content on radio.
In the US, it's difficult to access Indigenous language classes, and there aren't as many practitioners who can help keep it alive as there are students who are willing to come and learn. Is the reclaiming of Radio Africa with Indigenous content, is that helping revitalize languages?
It's a tricky one, because there are two positions that we see in the radio landscape. So on the one end, you get approaches that are very purist, that say that if a station is an isiXhosa station, people can only broadcast content in isiXhosa. And that approach is about language preservation, but critics say it excludes the fact that the way South African is set up, South African languages are set up, you are a multilingual person. So very rarely would you only speak one language, and a station that tries to enforce that is attempting to replicate the apartheid government's approach to radio, where the apartheid regime set up radio stations to divide in Africans by ethnicity. So there was a station for the AmaXhosa, there was a station for the Sotho's, and it was part of its apartheid policy, which said it was about separateness. And so there's a view that if you use radio in that purest sense, you are, you may think you are preserving the language, but you're perpetuating that. On the other hand, there are people who adopt a multilingual approach to radio, who recognize and say, well, because we are multilingual, even though this station is predominantly Xhosa, we will allow what we call translanguaging, and allow mixing of languages and translation in between so that it can be a platform where many more people can participate, not just pure isiXhosa speakers. And obviously the arguments against that is that it dilutes the language. People don't have a platform where it's just a single language. And obviously in those stations, English can encroach because people often translanguage between an indigenous language and English as opposed to an indigenous language and another indigenous language. But there's definitely a concern and a concerted effort to ensure that radio continues to be the primary platform where people can converse and engage in their languages. Television has got lots of limitations and online spaces have got lots of limitations, but we've got a policy in South Africa, and I know in other African countries as well, where public service broadcasting is mandated to feature indigenous languages, and in so doing, play a role in preserving and ensuring those languages are used to engage. But there isn't one approach. You know, people are doing it in different ways, and all of their goal is to ensure that our languages are preserved.
In one of your articles, you cite a recent study that 94% of South Africans over the age of 15 own a radio. It sounds like the younger generations are as committed to radio and sticking with radio as the older generations.
Yes. So with that, I think maybe the statement got a little bit lost in translation with the editor I was working with. So it's own a radio set in one form or other. So it's not necessarily just traditional radios. Many South Africans own a radio inbuilt in their phones. So they are engaging with radio, not as podcasts or streaming it, but you know how some, I don't know in the States, but our smartphones come with a radio thing in it. And you can listen to it whether you've got data or not. It's not linked to the internet. And in that way, then at the telly, it was 94% indicated they had engaged and listened to radio through either a physical radio set in their cars, in public transport, or in through their phones. And yes, it does demonstrate, and I thought the study was important to do that because of this conversation and view that young people are all about social media. And of course, South African young people are into social media like the rest of the world, but we see that the approach for them is for these technologies to converge. So social media is used to talk about what they've listened to on radio, and on radio, they use social media to speak into the conversations that are happening there. We're not seeing, as we are in Western countries, a migration away from traditional platforms like radio solely to digital and online platforms. We are seeing a convergence where young people are bringing the voices and engagements that happen online onto the on-air spaces. And that's one of the reasons that a lot of scholars are of the view that radio, just as a, because when we conceptualize radio, we are thinking beyond the physical set into the platform, which is an audio platform where people engage and it happens in real time, unlike a podcast. So there's definitely no sign that kind of platform will die out in our context, because young people want to participate in it, as we see from those kind of studies and statistics.
It sounds like young people are using more platforms to access and enhance their radio experience rather than to move away from radio. Does this help with intergenerational conversations? I know in the West, there's a sense that there's a generational divide because of the very different ways that people consume information and the ways that they interact with technology. Does this reinforcement of radio help with cross-generational relationships and conversations?
I wouldn't say so. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that programming is still very traditional in how things are structured. So you'll get, for example, a mid-morning show on our Xhosa radio station that you know the audience is just maybe moms at home or people in the office. And young people are at school, so they're not necessarily participating there because they physically are not able to be part of the conversation. So the fact that the programming has not adapted to a situation where the conversations are of interest to anyone listening in at any given time, I think is the limitation. But where we are seeing a shift is in young people shaping content on programs where they are audiences. So in drive time shows, for example, young people suggest topics that can be discussed. And I suppose those kind of programs, the breakfast show and the afternoon drive shows, are probably the most intergenerational. And there they would suggest topics, there they would add their voice and participate in the conversations. But because I think generally, because the programming is still segregated and has not adapted, there are still divided conversations that happen across generations. Where the integration happens is probably across class and across race, where the technologies mean that anyone can join in the conversation in any way because the barriers of entry are lowered. Whereas before it might have been a bit of a hurdle if you didn't have money to call, you wouldn't be able to participate in the conversation. But now through a much cheaper voice note, you can send a voice note and participate in the conversation. So it seems it's more of a within generations, but across different social categories, then the divisions are lowered.
Like any medium, over 100 years, radio has changed in its purpose in some ways, in its content in many ways. What do you see for the future of radio, specifically in South Africa?
Yes, so this is very tricky because of the rate of change with technology. I'm sure you are all having the conversation of what AI and what it does with voices means for people who are listening to music, but obviously also listening to radio. And so it's difficult to predict, but I would say my hope for radio and its future is that as it has done with television, as it has done with podcasting and digital media forms, it would find a way to adapt itself to come alongside whatever new technological advancement there is, because it is still the platform where many Africans gather around to have conversations. There was a study that I read recently that spoke about the fact that South Africa in particular has not fallen yet, crossing fingers, into some of the traps that countries like America have fallen into, where people are in these these different realities because of the kind of media they consume. So because of the single platforms that we have, like radio, where we all, although we've got very different views on politics, religion, etc., we all are coming together around one source and debating from there. There is, you know, there's an endurance and a trust in our media. And so my hope is that that would continue, that radio would continue to be the platform that brings us together, whether we've got, we prefer technology, or we prefer digital technologies or the traditional technologies, somehow it would continue to bring us together and continue to be that democratic space where, whether you are a CEO or whether you are the lowest paid worker, you can call in, you can make your views heard. Whether you speak isiXhosa or whether you speak Afrikaans, even French, you could access content that you understand and that you can speak back to. And yeah, all of us could find some space that we currently do on radio. So that's the one one wish I have. And then obviously the second is that we would find a way to keep up with the technological advancements, and change our structure of radio so that it adapts to what is happening. We do risk, as I pointed out, because our programming setup is still very old, we do risk losing things because we're not adapting to new ways that people consume content and adjusting radio content to suit that. So it would be that we keep up to date with that so that the platform remains the central gathering place for Africans.
When you work with your students, what are they excited about radio now and for the future?
So my students, I think, are very diverse in their consumption of radio. Many of them are more into the cultural and entertainment aspects, and although they obviously have to have an interest in news and current affairs, they interest is in the possibilities of using a platform like radio to create audiences that consume proudly South African content. So we've seen, you know, entities like Netflix coming and presenting so-called, in inverted commas, African content, and trying to speak to young people through adapted content. Like we've got Real Housewives here in South Africa, which is a sort of an American, I assume, a franchise that has now got African actors. And with radio, the young people are excited that the kind of content that you get on radio has not been influenced by other, you know, other contexts. It's still really grassroots. It's still their voices. It's still their expressions. And because there's so much space, there's always a need. So there's a lot of opportunities there for themselves to change the world. So there's a South African artist, Tyler, who recently won a Grammy for music that is linked to something called a genre called amapiano. And that, I think, is an example of what I'm trying to get at, that the sound, amapiano sound, really emerged from the airwaves of people just trying things out, being able to play around with sound. And then they found a new, uniquely South African sound that they have now exported to the rest of the world. And with other technologies, it's a little bit difficult to do that because there just isn't that much space space for experimentation and for expression for these young people. So I see them doing very interesting things with the project, whereas I would have expected a traditional approach maybe to a new story. Some of the ways that they approach it is very different, and they bring in, you know, their context and their cultural expressions and create a very dynamic project. So I think where they see themselves as radio practitioners would be as people who use the medium to send out uniquely African sounds to the rest of the world.
In the article, there's a timeline of the growth of radio development in Africa over the past 100 years. And a few points in the chart show the development of community stations, and then more specifically, campus radio stations. Do your students' projects make it onto a campus radio station?
So where I am currently, I've changed institutions, and the campus station is for all students on campus, which I think is a good thing, because sometimes we don't study what our gift is for various reasons. Maybe you end up doing engineering, but you've got a passion for broadcasting, but because of parents, etc. So the campus station is really open for all students. And of course, as media students, they would hopefully have an interest to take their content there, but it's not necessarily linked to the curriculum such that they produce content specifically for the station. There are other stations where that is the case. I know, for example, our University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg is quite linked to the Voice of Wits, which is a community station. And the students in that program, in their journalism program, are specifically tasked with producing content for the station. And there are, you know, slots set aside for that. But the model that we use is any student, you know, goes through the training and gets equipped, but it's not preserved only for media students. I must also point out that in the South African context, the advent of community media was really started at a campus at the University of the Western Cape, where I am, in 1993. So it was students who were also community activists that saw the need to have a community sector, because we did not have community radio in South Africa. And they saw the need, and, you know, they went through quite a lot, including some getting arrested in trying to ensure that this happened. And eventually it did. And now our community sector is the most vibrant, with over 200 and something radio stations, compared to commercial, which has about commercial and public service, which have about 40 combined. So community media really is a grassroots media, and radio in particular.
We're starting to run out of time. I want to ask you, what do you hope this episode sparks for listeners?
I hope it sparks an understanding of how media in Africa means different things, how the fact that the way media has changed is reflective of, you know, some of the social and societal changes that have happened. So going to the first point, that it means different things, it's not just about the technology. A lot of the conversations that sometimes happen in media scholarship, a new technology comes out and then people start to think about what it means. But for us, it's about what platforms the technology creates. So the introduction of indigenous languages, for example, in the 1940s in South Africa, it was seen by the apartheid government as a means of furthering, you know, the apartheid policy, but people co-opt it and they say, look, this is what it's set for, but this is what is possible for us because of the opportunities this medium presents. And with you know, states trying in a lot of the African countries trying to keep a stronghold on broadcasting generally, but radio in particular, and people still finding a way to mobilize through this medium, you know, demonstrating that it's not just about the technology, but the power and the platform that it presents. And then, yeah, the changes that are happening are worrying, but the trend has really been that because of what radio means, it has endured, and Africa for Africans, it's more than the platform. It is a medium that is central to our democracies. It is a medium that is central to our language preservations. It is a medium that can bridge or make up for the gender divides that we see in our countries because of how it is able to bring people together.
Thank you so much for being here today, Dr. Nkwala, and sharing with us your expertise on 100 years of radio in Africa. This is The Academic Life. I hope you will please join us again.